rabbis whom I invite to share the pulpit, to be free to talk of those concerns which are of deepest and most central interest to them at the moment. This is a service which allows us to share with our collegians those issues, the social, personal concerns which are at the top of their minds. And so I took the ambiguous theme, what the future demands of us, because I'm interested too to see what flies in the window. I'm reminded also of a confirmation examination I gave many years ago, in which I asked each of the confirmands to write out the Ten Commandments and to explain each. And one of them wrote to me, when they got to the commandment, honor your father and your mother. This means that we should respect our parents because they raise us to the best of our abilities. And I've always felt that we take a perhaps unwarranted but certainly innocent joy in the accomplishments of our young people. And since there's an old rabbinic proverb, morecha kohorecha, your rabbi, your teachers, or as your parents, I anticipate this morning's service as much as you do. I have the pleasure then to introduce to you four of the very fine young rabbis in Israel: Clifford Gurin, Susan Hellerstein, Leonard Kitchler, and Martin Krongold.
Good morning. Future. An adjective expressive of time yet to come. As a noun, it means the time that is to come. Future is a descriptive or indicative word, a word supposedly devoid of emotional content. Future describes an idea, a concept that has held promise since mankind's first sad stir. The promise of the future is a belief in the times to come, a faith that those times can be better than the present or past. This promise has given men the strength to cross unknown seas, strength to give up their daily bread, and strength to survive the machinations that man continually has perpetrated against his fellow man. Where once the future held promise, now it holds fear. We are overpopulated, the earth is undernourished, and all around us the threat of nuclear holocaust. Our generation has grown up with total destruction as a fact of life, a fact now accepted with the same ease as we accept the tax on our income. But the tax levied by the nuclear buildup is a spiritual tax, a slow sapping of the energy that we need to sustain optimism in the face of an ever more depressing daily life. The richness of the soul will give meaning to life when the world around us seems soulless. The moments of decision that earmark history all resound with the promise of the future. When Moses led the Jews out of Egypt, he did so with God's promise and with faith in that promise, a promise that diminished the misery and fear inherent in the moment. Renaissance man stepped out of the Dark Ages still upheld by religious belief. But another faith sustained his exploration. Man believed in himself, in the power of the mind, the power of the imagination to confront, understand, and coexist with the natural world around him. This was a faith rooted in humanity, warmth that sought to retrieve the world from its Gothic case of cold stone. Faith as it existed in the Dark Ages was tyrannical. The hierarchy of religious explication left no room for knowledge discovered by the individual, the knowledge wrought of experience. Life in the Dark Ages was mysterious, yet no one believed that there existed an as yet undiscovered body of knowledge. Life was mysterious because a religious hierarchy made life mysterious by placing the spiritual order beyond the common man's intellectual grasp. Faith was shrouded in a cloak of statutory laws, laws derived through multiple digressions from the original law, the law of Moses. Our time is not unlike the Dark Ages, only our taskmaster is not the specter of dogmatic religion. It is the monolithic, double-towered temple of science and technology. Who among us, except the specialist, the high priest of this pervasive sect, can claim an understanding of the technological world that surrounds us? We must be wary of science that makes us dependent on technology, and technology that finds its legitimacy in science. For example, consider the question of nuclear power. We're told the probable quantity of our future energy needs by scientists supported by the same industry that will profit from such a huge demand. The prophecy is self-fulfilling. It brings with it the nuclear power plant to supply the energy, brings the danger of a nuclear disaster, the danger of radiation leakage, and the problem of security against terrorist attack. In such a case, neither we, nor our senator, or our congressman can argue intelligently about the possibilities of such horrors. All we can do is hope that the specialists are in touch with a higher power, the power of scientific certainty. But there is no scientific certainty. Ultimately, we must act on faith. If the future is a sham, it's because we seek salvation from the very source of our deprivation. We have allowed technology and science to assume power over us. We have turned an analytic tool into an unquestionable institution. We gave ground to technology, to industry and the world around us, and now this ungrateful child wants to claim the territory within. Scientific projections of our future selves, of our characters, our lives, our needs and wants, deprive us of the mystery of self, of the mystery of the future. If promise will not lead us on, at least curiosity will. Scientific illuminations reduce the problem of the future to numbers, facts we can store and then transcend. But we cannot transcend our problems. War will close in on us. Hunger will enter our homes. Love will not defuse bombs, and goodwill will not feed starving people. Our problems are real and must be embraced, wrestled with as a real adversary. To admit a loss of faith in technology is to question the value of every measurable asset of modern life. But if we believe in science and its projections, if we invest technology with the power to solve our problems, we become willing accomplices in the robbery of our own souls. The future is not predictable, neither by science or by the palm reader. The future is created every day by the decisions that you and I make or refuse to make. If we admit to the statistics, if we live our lives in accordance with the numbers, then we're asking for the empty existence we will most surely get. The promise of the future is fulfilled by the way we live now. If we live responsibly, the future will reflect just that. Technology is not going to save us from the future. We must save ourselves, from ourselves, and from our absolute belief in an absolute power. Scientific projections can give us facts. With numbers, they can describe the future. But the future is lived. Experience breeds understanding. These undisciplined projections constitute a new type of knowledge, knowledge without understanding. By challenging technology, we demythologize the present. By questioning science, we can demythologize the future. We can reclaim it for ourselves by demanding back our human spirits. We must open ourselves up to the mystery of self. We must believe that there are powers within us as yet unexplored, strength within us that waits to be called on. Strength that will grow by being called on, by being exercised. We demand too little of ourselves and too much of the world around us. If we wish to regain the promise of the future, if we want to go forward with the faith that things can be better, then we must make and keep a promise to ourselves, the promise that we are the arbiters of the future, a promise to keep the responsibility for the future, and a promise that for the sake of the future, we will act responsibly today. Thank you.
Several nights ago, my dad, my sister, a friend, and I talked until 3 a.m. about where we've been and where we are going. My sister had already made a major commitment to the esoteric world of poetry. She is an English PhD candidate with remarkable intellectual achievements, but is frightened by her awareness of the limited possibilities for suitable positions, that the value and the importance of the arts and culture are not recognized by society. Unfortunately, they have little market value. My friend, also a sophomore, committed to the humanities, was acutely aware that his older friends who were humanities majors have partially abandoned their original intellectual endeavors and have shifted their focuses to become economics majors. This will provide a more favorable position in the marketplace. In my efforts to decide on a major, I share part of this same quandary. As we discussed our dilemmas with each other, the elder spokesman, my dad, reminded us to step back from our experiences, to distance ourselves from our immediate concerns, to gain insight into the larger picture. We reviewed some of the changes that had transpired in the past years. We were impressed with the similarities of the attitudes of the students in the 1950s and those in the 1970s. The pragmatism of the 50s, the materialistic concerns, and the apolitical nature of the students, the unquestioning acceptance of the status quo also characterized the students of the 70s. Things revolve. It is a recurrent cycle. We realized that we were part of this changing process, this recycling of behavior. We are not just critical observers, but participants. We, too, were concerned about the pragmatic aspects of our majors. Could we get a job, and could we maintain the lifestyle to which we are accustomed? Rather than to be part of the mindless masses in this subtle revolution, we expect to be an active part, well-prepared, knowledgeable, with insights into our own actions. In the dictionary, revolution is defined as a complete change, a cycle or series of events, a turnaround. History does not progress in a linear direction, but moves in complete cycles. When speaking of the revolutions of our times, we must think of them in terms of this circular motion, ending up at the beginning. In the recent preparation of a term paper on the French Revolution of 1789, I was struck by how important it was that the active participants, the urban masses, be knowledgeable about the ideals and the long-term objectives of their fight, rather than being swayed solely by the emotional rhetoric of their manipulative leaders. The French revolutionary crowds were described by Burke as the unutterable abominations of the furies of hell, shouting their meaningless slogans and destroying the stability of the ancient regime. Yet many Marxist historians have pointed out that the revolutionary crowds provided the decisive power that pushed the revolution forward, without which the revolution would have been unsuccessful. For myself, I want to be prepared to participate in the revolutions and the changes of our times. In assessing my educational goals, I must consider how I can be most effective. It is quite apparent that in the future there must be an integration of technological advances, their utilization, and their humanistic concerns. I am presently struggling with a balance of academic courses in these two polarized fields, the sciences and the humanities. For example, at Brown University on Tuesdays and Thursdays, I'm immersed in literature and history, and on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, I am bombarded with the principles of chemistry and physics. On one hand, I must delve deeply into the French Revolution, and on the other hand, I must be concerned with the path of an electron and intermolecular orbitals. Sometimes I feel at a loss trying to find any coherence and interrelation in my studies. The demands for scholarship in both are equally great. Precision, analysis, application, integration, uncertainties, and arguments are all important. As a matter of fact, I am impressed or depressed that the relationship between a proton and an electron in an atom are better understood and documented than the relationships between the popular masses and their leaders in the French Revolution. How little is known about the characteristics of the masses? Were they motivated by starvation, hatred, political ideology, or inflammatory propaganda? In the present day, there are similar problems and uncertainties. The reasons for conflict in Ireland, Israel, Iran, Cambodia, Africa, and the list goes on, are not fully understood. In my belief, science and technology alone have failed and will continue to fail to solve these problems. For example, more food can be produced than we can eat, or should eat, as my dad says. Yet, starvation is rampant in many parts of the world. Materialistic gains have clearly failed to provide happiness. Psychological conditioning, as proposed by Skinner, will not solve behavioral problems, nor will mass propaganda, nor will dictatorial regimentation. Pure sophistries, theoretical idealism, and intellectual philosophies break down when put to the empirical test of practicality. Effective scientists must be aware of the impact of their labors on society and must be able to communicate with all segments of society. While an effective humanist, whether he or she is a lawyer or physician, politician or teacher, must be aware of the impact of scientific influences. Neither can be isolated from each other. Somehow, I will try to straddle, or perhaps better stated, try to narrow the gap between these two polarized areas in my own personal career. Thank you very much. I appreciate this chance to share some of my ideas with you. And I don't claim that my ideas are universally held, but I know that some of my friends at school share my same dilemma.
When Rabbi Silver called me up at the University of Michigan to ask me if I'd speak on what the future demanded of me, I said that I would be very honored to do so. But I didn't really have much time to think about what I wanted to say at the time. Since I've been home, however, I've had some time to think really what the future does demand of me. And my immediate thought that popped into my head was, well, the first thing that I want to have is a good job and to be successful. But I was forced to think, well, what is a job? A job is just a means to an end. And so I guess I better concentrate on talking about success. So I was forced to draw up what my idea of success would be. And after thinking for a while, I thought the only person's destiny who I ultimately control is my own. So that I guess that my ultimate goal would be self-fulfillment. So I had to think for a little while longer and determine exactly what criteria I'd use to judge my self-worth. And I came up with four basic ones. The first one is hard work. I think that it's very easy to rationalize and say, well, if I would have tried harder, I could have gotten a better grade on my exam, or I could have done better in the course, or if I would have tried a little harder, I could have probably gotten the contract. But it's very hard to say, well, I gave it all that I had and I still couldn't do it, but at least it gives you a feeling of self-satisfaction that you tried your hardest. So I think it's very important to work as hard as you possibly can. The second criteria that I use to judge self-worth is honesty. I figure that any success or achievement which I might meet with isn't really worth it if it can't be done without willfully deceiving someone else. Third might sound like a strange sort of criteria, but I thought that keeping in shape is very important because happiness can't be achieved without good health. And I think that you're just taking a chance if you don't stay in shape that you wouldn't be taking if you did. The fourth criteria I came up with is making some sort of contribution to society. And after thinking about this for a while, I decided, well, exactly what sort of contribution am I going to want to make? What are the major issues that we're going to be facing in the coming years? So I came up with several of these. The first one is what we're going to do about our present situation with energy and transportation. And it really puzzles me what we're going to do when non-conservative estimates say that in 15 to 25 years, we're not going to have any oil left to run our cars, and that half of all industries in the country are in one way or the other related to the automobile, whether it's manufacturing or highway repair, highway construction, parts sales, or whatever. And I think that we're going to have to undergo a pretty major change in the future in order to cope with the shortage of oil. And it may mean a different mode of transportation. I'm not sure. It may mean a different source of energy, but I think that it's very interesting to think about. I think that one possibility of what's going to happen is that people will live in smaller dwellings, apartments, or smaller houses within a closer proximity to their job so that even walking is feasible. I see that this may be encouraged by the high interest rates and tight credit which our country is experiencing right now, which makes it hard for young people like myself, or perhaps people that are out looking for their first home, to get the money to be able to finance this. And I think it's going to be interesting to see whether we're going to be living in small, self-contained units, since it seems apparent that cities are declining in importance in the United States. Aside from the southwestern part of the country, cities have been rapidly declining in population, and suburbs have been rapidly growing. And I think it's going to be interesting in the coming years to see what happens. The second major issue I deemed as being important is the running of our country and choosing leaders. And I think that even though not all of us are leaders, I think that it's very important that we spend some time choosing leaders that we think will be effective. I think that if more people would have spent some time, that the city of Cleveland wouldn't have failed recently like it did. And also, I think another example which is staring us in the face right now is that the U.S. is thinking of defaulting on its Social Security payments. And I think that these are issues which most people probably aren't even aware of, but they should be. Thirdly, I think that it's very important to choose effective leaders, because I think that right now we're facing a dilemma of whether or not our country is going to become more socialist than it is now. The way I see it, I think that we are leaning more and more towards socialism, that there are fewer poor and fewer elite, and that there's more and more government-subsidized programs. And I think that's going to be a concern of our generation to decide what happens to that. The third issue that I thought was very important is keeping Israel as a state. I think if history has taught us nothing else, it's that the Jews were, there's a lot of prejudice in the world, and that the Jews are usually bearing the brunt of a lot of this prejudice. And I think that history has taught us that we need a Jewish homeland, both as a safeguard to Judaism and as a symbol to the rest of the world that we are a viable community. And I think that no one is going to support Israel but the Jews, ultimately, and so that we as Jews should worry about that. I think that the future is going to be a challenging one, and through hard and honest work, I hope to make it a successful one. Thank you.
When I graduated from high school, I had little conception of my future. I really didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, but I probably thought I knew everything about everything. Once I got to college, however, I found that my omniscience was probably only the norm. I met people whose mental abilities and achievements simply staggered me. My initial shock was fortunately short-lived. I realized that I too had certain abilities. I found that my college years have aided me in recognizing and developing my skills, and have guided me towards certain goals and opportunities into my future. College is definitely the place where many students' characters are molded. In the past, universities were branded as being hotbeds for radicals and podiums for discontent. Today, these same characteristics are evident even at conservative Northwestern University. There are your hippie types and pot smokers, but they don't seem to be the ones who are making trouble anymore. They are accepted as part of the student body. Instead, there's a good deal of heightened awareness by a significant number of the student population on just about all issues. While the grounds for discontent are not as pervasive as the Vietnam War, issues such as divestiture of the university stock in South Africa and committees to keep the administration in line with student needs are very common. Protest is no longer a cry against something which is intangible, such as a war 10,000 miles away, but student activism is kept alive and at a very tangible level, I feel that this synthesis of protest is good. While I cannot directly link myself to the tragedies of Kent State, I am aware of its social and political innuendos in a way that my parents are not. To me, it seems that on college campuses, the mid-60s to early 70s, were a violent crying out against something which students had to participate in but had little say over. This form of initiative set a precedent which I see my college peers taking up, although without taking over buildings or fighting police. Hopefully, this new kind of constructive protest will be carried on by my generation into their jobs and offices, creating an atmosphere of self-reflection on all of their actions. As you can imagine, though, students don't just protest. Most of their time is spent with their books and their friends. Days are quite long, classes, studying, and final exams are still the great equalizers. Once one gets past the rigorous demands of introductory courses, which try and jam your head with a million and one facts, you begin to understand the intricacies behind ideas which you used to hold on every topic. You realize that things are not so simple, but that your idealistic notions were good starting grounds for delving into topics of further depth. By the time I get out of college, I don't expect to have covered every academic area. Instead, I hope to have gained an understanding on how to relate with people, to at least cope with a wide range of problems and issues, and be able to speak out as an authority on only a few. Someday, my training for a job will classify me as an authority in something. My ideals, education, and training will have to be translated into actions that will affect others. In that vein, my future demands that I stick to my morals and ideals while understanding their implications on those around me. I see a number of current issues which will demand a good deal of attention in the future. I don't expect to make a final decision on any of them, but I'd like to share a few of them with you. Probably the most pressing problem I perceive would have to be the current energy situation of the United States and the world. While my parents lived in the United States and had plenty of available cheap energy, by the time I was 15 years old, I was learning about how one commodity can make a world economy shake and how a few large companies could influence my everyday life. Those in a position to change this problem have given it only lip service, while the United States falls deeper into the problem. While alternative energy sources are funded in order to give a semblance of federal action, imports are increased at increasing prices, and oil companies are allowed to look for more energy at even higher prices. To add injury to insult, one of the first budget cut proposals to balance the federal budget is a near 20% cut from the Energy Department, which heads search for new energy sources. To me, the problem was vividly made when there were long gas lines back in the winter of 1973. I don't think the American economy can absorb too many more economic crises, and the emphasis for a self-reliant, clean system of energy is the basis for a solution which I would like to press for in the future. Dr. Milton Rosenberg, a social psychologist from the University of Chicago, made a trip across town last spring to my dormitory to discuss some current social behavior with us. One idea which he implanted in my mind was from a Pentagon friend of his, what he called the what-if principle. What he was talking about was the escalating arms race, which continued to grow worse under the notion of, what if the other side has more or better weapons? Since World War II and through the McCarthy era, the Bay of Pigs and the Vietnam War, there seems to have been the need to scare your enemies with your nuclear might, only paying slight attention that a full-scale nuclear war could very well wipe out half the United States in 20 minutes. After 25 years of such thinking, there has come the realization that such military practices are vicious games which play with too many lives. While President Carter in his inaugural address hoped to remove nuclear threats, his thinking is only a beginning. I am not willing to accept such a world situation and would press for a solution to the question, what if we were to do away with all thermonuclear devices? To me, the future also demands that I support ideas which will provide for a more peaceful, interdependent world. Within 50 years, I see this as meaning that the rest of the world, which is presently quite poor and still developing, will be soon demanding a part of the world spotlight along with the United States. This may mean that nationalism will become the predominant foreign policy of much of the world. As the United States has already felt through the oil crisis, working with nationalistic countries is not easy, nor is it profitable. But I don't think belligerent policies on the part of the United States is right either. Instead, I have to start thinking what the rights of these developing countries are and where my needs start intruding on these nations' rights. For example, Are we to start heavily involving ourselves in a developing Africa for the purpose of any neo-colonial policies like the Russians and Chinese seem to be doing? It will be difficult for sure, but there will come a point where development will be adversely affecting too many without benefiting enough. The results do not have to mean an isolationist United States, but rather one which forces me to spend my time and my money in a slightly different way than I do now. We may be forced to improve our technology to overcome certain shortages or accept a slightly lower standard of living. But most importantly, I have to try and relate to the global problems of other nations. Before I can partake in all these notions, however, I have to concern myself with the present by finishing my education and getting a job. I imagine that all of my comments are still several years down the line before they are fully felt, so I have time before I see $2 per gallon gas or the Soviet Army in Shaker Heights. But these are a few ideas which I have thought about, idealistic maybe, but my ideals, along with the ideals of the youth of the nation, will help determine how I live in the future. Thank you.